May 18th, meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. Members, we have quite a lot to do today, so that's why we started at 8 o'clock. We may be starting at 8 o'clock on a pretty regular basis now as the Rules Committee becomes more and more center ring, so to speak. And so we have Representative Gelster here. I think I'll start with House Bill 3555, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 3555. Mr. Stenberg, would you like to tell us about
this? Yes, members, you'll remember we had this on the 11th of May. This directs the State Commission on Children and Families to establish a shaken baby syndrome prevention program. You have the dash two amendments from Representative Gelster that replaces all substantive provisions of the measure, and it creates a seven-member task force on the prevention of shaken baby syndrome.
And members, you should have the dash twos in front of you. They were distributed at our desk this morning, and Representative Gelster is here to tell us about them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelster from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. I'll be very brief. A couple of things that the dash two does, it moves the lead agency from the Commission on Children and Families to the Department of Human Services. It does create a seven-member task force, which includes members from DHS, a member from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, someone from the Oregon Pediatric Society, someone from the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, and the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Team, a representative and a senator. And the task force will look at developing the parameters for a statewide shaken baby prevention program. It will look at the question of what type of prevention programs are currently being done in our hospitals, and it will look at the question of whether or not this should be a voluntary or mandatory program after it's developed. The other piece of this that I think is important is that at the end, when we worked on this, the Oregon Hospitals Health, the Hospital Association has indicated tremendous support for this bill and this project, and they have indicated their willingness to provide the work support to do this. There's a provision in the bill to allow that, even though you can't directly mandate a private organization to do something. And the last thing that I just want to mention to put on the record is that I have been contacted by the Oregon Emergency Physicians Association, and it's their hope that the task force will also be talking more broadly about other places that this prevention program might be included, including home births and midwives as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Representative Gelster. And my notes from our last hearing, I had a note that there were something like $10 million in federal funds possibly available to us if we wanted to apply for them. Is that
Yes, Madam Chair. There are about $10 million in federal funds for the entire nation. However, having a task force will put us in a better position to be able to apply for those funds. There are also other private grant funds through a variety of nonprofit organizations. That's the other benefit of doing this through a task force. This task force will be able to look for and identify resources that can support the statewide implementation of this program.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Gelster? Okay. Thank you very much for presenting this. And we are in a work session. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3555.
Representative Buckley has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 3555. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. The amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3555 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Bill 3555 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Yes, Representative Buckley.
Just appreciation to Representative Gelser for bringing this forward, and I do look forward to getting the report back in October 2008 or before, and moving forward on this issue.
Further discussion? Okay, Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Buckley?
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Motion carries. And the bill will go to the floor. And Representative Gelster, would you like to carry this bill? Great. Okay. Thank you. I will close the work session on House Bill 3555. And I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2909A. Mr. Stenbridge, to please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2909A establishes a statute of repose in product liability actions equal to the useful safe life of the product at issue. It defines useful safe life to mean the period of time beginning on the date that the product is delivered to the product's first purchaser or lessee and ending on the earlier of 20 years or the date on which the product would not reasonably be expected to perform in a safe manner or could not reasonably be stored in a safe manner. It creates a presumption that the useful safe life of a product is 10 years, which a plaintiff may rebut by a preponderance of the evidence. It applies to all causes of action, whether arising before, on, or after the effective date of the act, but does not revive already barred causes of action. It clarifies that limitation and repose periods for construction defects claims apply to actions involving manufactured dwellings and prefabricated structures. You have the dash A12. First, I should point out that this came from the House Committee on the Judiciary. They give you the dash A version. The A engrossed version came out on a 6-2 vote. Do pass as amended. You have the A12 amendment, which adds a definition for R-type metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs and specific parameters for civil actions for damages caused by those light bulbs. It specifies the circumstances under which liability continues for damages caused by a product after the expiration date of the product's useful safe life.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. We do have quite a few people signed up to testify on this bill. So I'll start in order and call Richard Lane. Please come forward. Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm here to testify in support of the 2909-812 amendment. By way of background, I thought I'd take a moment and explain to you a little bit about the ultimate repose and statute of limitations in existing law. It's not an original thought, but somebody explained it to me this way. Statutes of limitations act to open a window in which you can bring a claim. Ultimate repose statutes close that window to bar you from ever pursuing a claim. And under existing law in Oregon today, if you do not suffer an injury as a result of a defective product within 8 years of the date that it was sold, the window closes and you're forever barred from pursuing any type of a remedy. And the unfairness of that can be demonstrated in over the years the legislature has taken the time to carve out special exceptions to this. We have a number of exceptions over the 8-year statute for side saddle exploding gas tanks, for asbestos-related products, for breast implants, for IUDs. Any type of significant claim that suddenly arises, the fix is to carve out another exception. And what 2909 initially offered to do was change the problem, which is the short 8-year ultimate repose statute. The majority of states, greater than 40 of them, have no ultimate repose statute. Many of them have what's called the useful life statute. And that's what 2909-12 offers the legislature, a chance to adopt what's called the useful life of a product. And that means that you are able to pursue a claim if you're injured as a result of a defective product if the injury occurs during what's considered the useful life of the product. So 2909-12 changes Oregon law from the strict 8 years, forever barred, window closed, there's no exceptions, to a period of time from the date of sale that you can bring an action over the useful life or for an injury arising over the useful life of the product. I'll give you a simple example. Let's talk about a washing machine. A person buys a washing machine. Under existing law, if you are injured before the 8th year anniversary of that sale, you can bring an action for the injury. So your daughter or granddaughter ends up being injured because of some defect in the washing machine. You can pursue a claim. If the very same defect causes an injury 8 years and a day after the date of sale, there's no exception. You cannot pursue any recovery against the manufacturer for the defect. And we think that's entirely unfair. The fact that we use all these exceptions over the years demonstrates it. There's one other provision in the A12, And that's another exception, if you will, and that has to do with these halide lights that you may have heard about. It's a carve-out to allow a number of teachers in the Lake Oswego School District area, as I recall, to pursue a claim because, again, those light bulbs that caused injuries were purchased and installed more than 8 years before those individuals suffered injury. So I think it's on the second page. There's a carve-out for the halide lights to take care of that particular problem. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger. Thank you. Let's go back, if you don't mind, just for a second on your washing machine.
Okay.
Washing machines are something I understand. Halide lights, perhaps not. But washing machines, I unfortunately know too well. There's nothing, however, I mean, I don't know how long a washing machine lasts, but on the 8-year, 1-year day, or just before the 8-year, 1-year day, there's nothing the manufacturer could have done about how that washing machine was maintained, what other things would have been done to that washing machine. I mean, at some point, that washing machine doesn't look remotely like the washing machine that walked out of the factory that they're responsible for, and yet they're still responsible for whoever's arm went in there. Washing machine injuries are sort of ridiculous, but you understand my point. I don't know of anybody that's been hurt by a washing machine, but I'm sure you do.
Chair Rosenblum, Representative Berger, members of the committee, I do understand exactly the point that you're trying to raise, and I'll take a stab at it. And part of it, if you don't mind the explanation, lies in the body of law referred to as products liability and not having to do with the ultimate repose statute. In order to pursue a products liability claim for any product defect, it's required upon the plaintiff bringing the action to show that that defect was present at the time of initial sale. So you're talking about something that was defective at the time that it left the manufacturers. And there's various defenses inside of products liability law for misuse of the product that would bar your type of claim. That would be something that would be developed inside the evidence of the case. And that exists right now. So the defendant manufacturer would be arguing that it did not have a useful life of, let's say, 10 years, if we adopted the useful life. The manufacturer would argue no. In fact, that washing machine was only going to be serviceable for 2 years, and then you were required to purchase another one. The plaintiff would say, no, your advertisement said this is the only washing machine you're ever going to need. And that's the type of case that would be able to be brought. You would have to be required to demonstrate that the defect existed at the time that it left the manufacturer's hand, that there's been no alteration, no misuse of the product. Otherwise, you're barred from the recovery. And there are known cases having to do with a washing machine. And I use the washing machine only because everybody does tend to understand a washing machine more than halide lights.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, in the approximately, I think you said 40 states that have the useful life definition, is the language that we're seeing here in the Dash H-12 amendments the same as other states have? I guess my concern is line 8, the definition is would not reasonably be expected to perform, which seems to be a very broad statement. I'm not sure how that gets defined.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, members of the committee, if I misspoke, I'm going to correct that. The large majority of states in the country have no ultimate repose statute. Oregon happens to be the second most restrictive behind either South Carolina or North Carolina. I think they have a 6-year statute of ultimate repose. Far and away, the majority of states have none. It's been either legislatively overruled or declared unconstitutional by that state's highest court. Then you move into a second tier, and I'd say the next number that have any type of repose is the useful life. So the language in here comes from the Washington useful life statute, and I think that's a model that's used by the states that have adopted a useful life statute.
Thank you very much. Just one follow-up?
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the Washington statute's been in place for...
Chair Rosenblum, Representative Buckley, a while. Okay. I don't have a specific number for you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Lane, I had a related question because I'm looking at the chart you provided us, and it does look like the vast majority of states do not have a time limit at all. But I'm looking at the states that do. There are a handful, and it is North Carolina where the length of time is 6 years that you have to file a lawsuit, and then Oregon is the next most restrictive at 8. So it sounds like this law would put us, I mean, with the amendment, would put us well within the mainstream on these. Is
that correct, Madam Chair?
Are you not looking at this?
Yeah,
it was attached to your, wasn't this attached to your testimony?
It was attached to my testimony at the time that it was in the House Judiciary Committee. So my apologies, I did not bring additional copies with me this morning.
Maybe we can make copies for committee members. I'm sorry,
I thought it would follow.
I didn't realize I had privileged information.
We have another original.
We'll get copies.
I have another original. I'd be happy to hand up.
I don't know if you wanted to respond to what I just said or just agree with me, but...
No, I wish the committee members had the chart. But once you do have a chance to see the chart, you will find that Chair Rosenbaum is correct. Oregon has an 8 years. North Carolina has a 6 years. That is the only shorter one. Far and away, there are no statute of ultimate repose by the states. There's a 10, a 12 that I see scanning down here quickly. Oregon would be the second most restrictive in the nation.
Thank you. And Mr. Lane, while we're waiting for someone to come make copies, why don't you just hand your extra copy to our committee assistant, and she can pass it around so committee members can see it. Other questions for this witness? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just talk about, and maybe the chart will explain this, but talk about the magic of the new proposed length of time. Obviously, you made the case that the current length of time is unreasonably short. Talk about why the proposed length of time, why it shouldn't be longer than that, why it shouldn't be shorter than that. What's the...
Read the amendment.
Read the amendment.
Representative Roblin, did you wish to answer?
There's an amendment to this. A12, which is the one we're really talking about. It has no limit other than you should be looking for an A12.
A12.
No. But doesn't the A12 just impact just the halide issue?
No. Read the front part of the A12.
We'll let the witness answer.
Chair, Representative Hunt, members of the committee, the magic, if you will, lies approximately on page 1 of the -12 lines 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the -12s. What you have right now is a hard and fast, no exception, 8 years. The 2909, and then obviously there were dash up to 11s up to this point. Right. So I'm trying to keep them all straight. There were various proposals regarding rebuttable presumptions of a certain amount of time with hard caps, and what the A12 does is just cleanly leave the bill in a place called the useful life, and that is a matter of time that may differ with products. But that is the amount of time, so it's sort of incumbent upon the plaintiff to demonstrate that the injury occurred within the useful life of the particular product that's alleged to have caused the defect.
And does the bill still have that 20-year maximum, or is that eliminated?
Yeah, that's what Chair Rosenbaum, that was eliminated. I think that was maybe in the -5, but I don't want to be quoted on that.
Okay. Other questions for this witness? Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Next, we'll call Kevin Mannix.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem, and I'm also the director of a group called the Oregon Tort Reform Coalition. I'm here today to... thank you for considering this bill, and on behalf of the 12,500 lawyers in Oregon, I would like to thank you for this potential ticket to a great opportunity to greatly enhance litigation in the state of Oregon. I once thought that with less lawyers in the House and the Senate, we would see simpler language in legislation, but that hasn't happened. This bill today creates a mishmash of the whole issue of statutes of limitations and statutes of ultimate repose. You just heard the testimony about the statute of ultimate repose, but think of the statute of ultimate repose as the second door. I'd rather not use the window analogy. I think doors would be better because people walk through doors. Most states have got a first door, a statute of limitations about when you can bring a civil action for property damage, for personal injury, and for death. And in many states, they're satisfied that the first door does the trick. So there is no second door. Oregon has a moderately, I'll even say, somewhat generous first door. It's pretty wide, and you can get through it in a lot of cases in terms of a statute of limitation, the time limit in which you can bring an action. But if there's any question, we have a second door that pretty much is narrow and is often closed, and it's based on a time frame. I say often because we've made some exceptions. We put a little lock on the door, and from time to time, the legislature has handed someone the key, and they've allowed them to unlock that door and get through because the legislature was convinced that justice called for that exception. And that is why we see, if you look at the statute, see, there's a saddlebag gas tanks exception. There's an exception for extension cranes used near high-powered lines. These are things that have been added by the legislature, finding that the standards of the law were not just as to given circumstances. You have today, in the Dash 12 amendments, an exception for which you could probably make a good case based on what I've read in the news accounts. I'm not an expert in this matter, but it appears that you may find in school buildings and office buildings throughout the state certain lights which are still out there, which are endangered, and where people may need to be able to make a case. And I would suggest to you that this bill would be a great vehicle for taking just that one exception and saying, the case has been made. We really ought to be allowing people some additional time to come forward because of the amount of time that those tubes are out there in the real world, based on a common sense view of what's going on. One might be able to make that specific case just as you could for the saddlebag gas tanks and as you could for the extension cranes for high-powered poles. And that's something that legislators can do from a common sense and fairness perspective. Look at the facts. You're almost a grand jury for justice as to people being able to be heard as to these matters. But I'd invite you to simply read the language, and I'm not going to read it out loud. I'd have to put on my Monty Python voice because of the incredible complication that's introduced into the law. Just take a look at page 2, lines 1 through 9, which are replicated in the Dash 12 amendments. Believe me, by the way, you have to modify those Dash 12 amendments to take out the other stuff. If you can read that even 10 times over and understand it, I think you should become a lawyer. Because we're going to have to read it over 9 times and probably over 9 years. And yes, we will delight in the opportunity to spend innumerable dollars of clients on both sides fighting over what this really means. What is the useful life of a new or remanufactured product? And again, I don't want to take up your time by being sarcastic and reading this language. But I know I would spend hours trying to create charts and graphs to figure out who goes which way. You can go back a page to something that Representative Buckley was asking about, the first discovered language. I notice it now says, in the exercise of reasonable care. Please understand that the current statute talks about, if you go back to lines 6 through 9, and then if you look at some other lines in there, there's discussion about reasonably should have done this, that, or the other. We've now introduced a phrase, in the exercise of reasonable care, which is longer. Every time you add a word to a civil statute in regard to potential litigation, you have just leveraged the opportunity for lawyers to argue and for lawyers to appeal and for cases to be delayed while we get an opinion from the Supreme Court what it really meant. This bill, which came to you from the Judiciary Committee, presents a potpourri of opportunities for lawyers to argue. Now, Oregon, if you look at national charts about civil justice, is in the yellow zone. We're not a green zone state, which is thought of as being, depending on your perspective, you know, very easy. We're somewhere in the middle, the yellow zone. And there are some red zone states for litigation where it's pretty hard. to bring litigation. We're somewhere in the middle range, and we've been pretty careful over the years about trying to maintain some balance. I respectfully suggest to the committee that the balance that can be maintained has to do with addressing the R-type metal halide or mercury vapor light bulb situation, which has come forward and makes a case for exceptions, and not trying to re-sculpt the rest of the landscape of the civil justice system. And I'll add one other simple example of unintended consequences. We are not an asbestosis crisis state. There are states where there's been such a crisis as to asbestos and asbestosis litigation that they've had to craft special bills and create special commissions to try to figure out how to handle all those cases. We've generally been able to take care of those cases in the state, but now at page 3 of this bill, lines 25 through 28, we blew up the building. There aren't going to be any windows. There aren't going to be any doors you go through. A product liability civil action for damages resulting from asbestos-related disease is not subject to ORS 30.905 or any other statute of repose in the Oregon Revised Statutes. That's the kind of language which is very dangerous, which just says, hey, come on in and sue me. Now, again, I encourage the committee to carefully look at the language of this, and I realize that there are very few lawyers left in the legislature, whether that's good or bad. I was glad to be one of those lawyer legislators for 10 years. But in this kind of case, I think you should call upon the proponents of any change in the civil statutes to make a very strong case that it's going to work and to deal with all the host of possible scenarios. The case can probably be made for the operative part of those Dash 12 amendments. I don't think the case can be made for the rest of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for this witness, Vice Chair Buckley?
Madam Chair, can we ask Mr. Minix to use his Monty Python voice? Mr. Minix, I'd love to hear that sometime. Can you tell me, in instances where a product such as the light bulbs that we're talking about in this bill, why is it better for the legislature, for people like us, to be the ones to, in the time we have in one of our sessions, to be the people to determine whether that product fits in the category of exception? Why is that not better placed in a court of law?
Madam Chair, Reverend Buckley, I think that is a perfect question and very fair. And the answer is hindsight. Generally, when we set up statutes of limitation and statutes of ultimate repose, we're trying to look to the future and set some standards. Every once in a while, we realize with experience we were wrong. And the legislature can then say, you know what, we were wrong and we're opening the door, or we're providing you with the key and you can unlock that door, that statute of ultimate repose door, because history now tells us we were wrong. Let me get to the washing machines. What if we find 5 years from now that something was wrong in the design of washing machines built 15 years ago so that they explode? That may be ludicrous, but actually with electronic devices these days, who knows? And that someone reasonably should have contemplated that when they designed those machines, and they didn't. And then we have the cases arise where they're exploding. So you say, well, wait a minute. We're not going to allow that statute of ultimate repose to apply because we now find that something we didn't anticipate as a society is happening, and we're going to allow that to proceed. But that does call for a policy judgment where you've extended something. Otherwise, in terms of the economics of our society, you want manufacturers and distributors and, yes, customers to have some sense of what the time frame is for them to bring a cause of action and how much they should invest in terms of insurance coverage and in terms of protections for the long term when they invest in the cost of that product. Generally, they should be able to anticipate that. Occasionally, someone screwed up, and then the legislature may say this is a major policy issue. And could we have anticipated the whole question about these fluorescent tubes? Probably not. Well, then let's open the door and allow that to proceed.
Mr. Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Kevin, I'm not a lawyer, and
you don't play one on TV.
And I don't play one on TV, but if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is between our statute of limitations and our statute of ultimate repose, we stand in the middle of states that has sort of a reasonable windows or doors, as you call them, for folks to bring suit, but not an open end where anything goes and litigation could go on forever. Is that And as a result, our insurance rates and our the way we do business here has is sort of in a good balance. Is that the...
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, you're right on with that. And in fact, there's been a movement in some of the states that are, and I'll call the green zone of litigation, to reform their laws because of the problems that they're now encountering in terms of insurance, in terms of manufacturing opportunities, creation of manufacturing jobs. And in this environment right now, we are in that middle range, but we would be shifting towards a litigation easy range, which creates problems for us economically.
Go ahead. Yeah. And do you think this does have, in terms of what could happen, people don't realize what a manufacturing state we are, particularly with regard to transportation manufacturing. People forget. We don't build cars, but we build lots of things that move. And so this ultimately can impact our sort of industrial base.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, absolutely. When businesses are looking, investors are looking where to invest in a complex, a manufacturing complex. One of the things they're going to look at, what is the business environment in terms of litigation? And they're certainly looking at things where we've had success, as the chair knows. We've had a success in establishing a pretty balanced workers' compensation system, not perfect, but pretty balanced, which is an important factor in businesses being able to site here and stay here. Well, litigation environment is another factor that is looked at, and this does have an impact. This kind of legislation has a serious impact, especially because this is so mushy. This is goulash.
We're getting Monty Python, I think.
Yes, Vice Chair Berger. I mean, Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mannix, when you mentioned the Section 6 of the bill on page 3 in terms of asbestos product liability, civil action, can you take me back through that a little bit? From your testimony, it seemed like you were saying that this bill would somehow, correct me if I'm wrong, this bill would somehow limit a citizen's ability to bring a suit? I'm reading the opposite.
You know? Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, no, actually you are correct in reading the opposite. What I'm saying is actually this blows away any limitations, and we've actually had a pretty balanced environment in this state in regard to asbestos litigation. You don't read stories about horror stories of massive, complicated cases where 80-year-olds go back and say, I may have asbestosis, I'm not sure, but I think I've discovered it, and therefore I want to sue that ship manufacturing company. I better not use ships, some land-based manufacturing company from the early 50s. In other words, you open the door for the opportunity to bring the litigation, and other states have got a real crisis going where they've had to figure out, how do we deal with this? Oregon has been in the middle range, and you know, the cases come up, they get dealt with, but this opens the door and says, do it.
May I follow?
Follow up.
Please make and clarify for me. I thought that was one of the exceptions we already had in the law in terms of the ultimate repose, that asbestos was one of the exceptions. Am I incorrect?
We have, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, if you read the actual current laws here in Section 6 other than the bold-faced, and you may bring a product liability civil action for damages resulting from asbestos-related disease commenced not later than 2 years after the date on which the plaintiff first discovered or in the exercise of reasonable care should have discovered the disease and cause thereof. So you have general, I am 80 years old and I've just discovered. Now, the problem is they do have the statute of ultimate repose, how many years have passed. Well, this just says there will be none. Now, you may decide you need a 20-year or 30-year statute. Put in something that's specific. There is additional language in here about other things under sub 2 and the contractors, and there are limitations that were carefully crafted over the years. I'm saying this piece has just been thrown in here as sort of a rolling grenade thrown into the room, saying, well, we're going to take out any limitation as to repose. And I think that kind of loose, open-ended exception is exactly the opposite of what ought to be done. If the case can be made that a certain number of people are inappropriately being responded to in terms of a grave health crisis as a result of asbestos exposure, consider that case and establish a statute that specifically deals with a reasonable time frame that ought to be imposed. This says no time frame.
Thank you for clarifying that. I do appreciate that. I think in terms of asbestos, since we already have seen it as being a crisis of sorts for people, this would put them, if we did not have this, it would put them in the position where they would have to come to the legislature then and ask for legislation in order to move forward.
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, And the question I just asked, and because I don't deal in that area of litigation, is there a crisis in Oregon of people who have this condition not being able to have access to the courts? I haven't read about it in the papers. I haven't heard about it. And I may be wrong. Maybe a case has been made, and that case should be considered. But at the present time, my immediate response would be, where are the problems? Where are the people coming forward saying, I suffer from asbestosis, and the doors have been closed to me in Oregon for an opportunity to be heard?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix, that's a great segue to a couple of questions I wanted to pose to you. And it's true we have fewer lawyers than when you served in the legislature, but the ones we have are of very high quality. So the statement you just made about where are the people coming forward, it seems to me you argue that the current law is working well. I would argue the current law is an illustration of that old legal maxim that hard cases make bad law, because since I've been in office, I have seen a parade of horribly injured people have to come into this building and make a case for why they should be let out under a very restrictive law. And whether it's victims of those exploding side saddle gas tanks who were burned and maimed, or, you know, asbestosis, or now the halide light bulbs, which is the latest one, it seems like if we had a law that was working well, we wouldn't have to keep accepting people from it. And that would seem to me to argue that we need to change it in some way. So what am I missing?
Madam Chair, think of it as a triage system, where you make some determinations as to who proceeds and who doesn't. And your statute of limitation and your statute of ultimate repose do provide a triage system where choices are made about who proceeds and who gets to go to court. Occasionally, that system doesn't work well. And the legislature has heard about it and has modified it. I've sat in this body and sponsored legislation which extended the statute of limitations for victims of child sexual abuse who later in their lives became aware of the impact of that abuse on them and were past the age of adulthood and in the past were unable to bring legal action. And they came in front of the Judiciary Committee, and I sat there and heard the testimony of these victims about repressed memory syndrome, delayed memory syndrome, the trauma that occurred, and we changed the law. And at that point, we changed the law up to age 40. Later, the legislature made additional adjustments. But we said, we're satisfied that there is a case to be made for opening the door here, and we did. And you read about some of those cases, sadly, in Oregon, and you saw what happened with a lot of litigation recently. We deliberately opened the door because the case was made. On the other hand, we didn't open the door to anybody who was ever abused anywhere at any time, saying, you know, everybody gets to go to court. Why? Because there's so many unknowns out there. How much burden do you place on the courts? How much legitimacy is there to that class of cases? And so the legislature needs to decide there's a legitimate class of cases that needs that additional opportunity. And what I'm saying in terms of this bill is I don't think the case has been made where people have come forward saying we've been denied justice because of the existing law.
And then you had, I think, commented that the language useful life of a product was problematic because we don't know what that means. But I'm looking at other states, and it looks to me like at least four or maybe five other states already use that, and that includes states like Idaho and Kansas that aren't exactly a bastion of trial lawyer power. So it must be working in those states.
Madam Chair, quite so. On the other hand, the language that any state uses is part of a matrix of statutes. And if you have the complete matrix of statutes in front of you, you have a better idea about what the push and pull is. And they may have a push there with useful life, but they have a pull somewhere else. Every state has got its own system of civil litigation, and there's so many pieces that come together. And I grant you that some states have found that language useful. And in fact, someday we may end up having to look at their appellate decisions to find out what it really means if this legislation passes. But what I'm saying is I'm looking for the case that the matrix isn't working in this state. And again, the big picture is what do we do for our economic environment, for jobs, the opportunity for people to work, and how much impact do we have on businesses choosing not to come here or not to expand here because of their fear of liability issues? And there's the push-pull for us.
Thank you
very much.
One last question?
Yes, one more question, Representative Buckley.
Mr. Mance, it's so much fun. I just enjoy The issue of manufacturers being here or not, it really doesn't matter whether a product is manufactured in the state of Oregon. This is the use of the product in our state. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, you're completely correct. I'm talking about the business environment. For instance, we can talk about our workers' compensation system being limited to injuries to Oregon workers, but it's a signal to how we handle things in the state, and it's sort of a symbol for a variety of other things that are looked at. It's not going to have a specific economic impact in that sense, although it's interesting that some states who have major manufacturers somehow manage to write their product liability laws in a way that tend to protect those manufacturers because they tend to protect their own. There's a political reality.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Max. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And obviously, one of the challenges of this, we have a committee of 7 non-lawyers. I'm very thankful for the Judiciary Committee for sending this over to us. So
yeah, thanks.
This. Where all the lawyers are, they sent it to us. I'm seeing the A12 amendments for the first time today, so it appears to me, from my non-lawyer perspective, that we really got two dominant things. Well, really three things. The halide light thing you've already addressed. Setting aside the whole useful safe life piece from Section 3, you have the A12s in front of you?
Yes.
If you look at subsection 4 here, where it talks about really three exceptions to the standard, in this case they're the exceptions to the useful safe life standard, but would you agree that these three exceptions would be reasonable exceptions to a statute of ultimate repose or whatever the standard would be, where you've got a case where there's a warranty, you've got a case of intentional misrepresentation under B, and you've got a case of that the exposure would not have been discovered by a reasonably prudent person, which I think is a term that actually does have good case law in Oregon. I mean, do those, setting aside the whole useful safe life issue, do those three exceptions to whatever our standard is seem like reasonable exceptions from your perspective?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the first part is an important point, because when you're dealing with a warranty, in effect, someone has said, well, I'm taking it on myself to promise you that this is good. And they've made that decision, and I think that they can be held responsible for that decision. The second part, again, has to do with intentional misrepresentation. And again, you've opened the door there to some extent about someone arguing about whether or not it occurred. But assuming that it occurred, that is the legitimate argument. Well, you intentionally misrepresented this to me, therefore, we're not going to give you the protection of the law. Intentional is a very important word. They're a very important word. As to the third part, though, the useful safe life of the product, the injury, death, or damage caused by exposure would not have been discovered by a reasonably prudent person until after the useful safe life of the product had expired. That one is back into the mush category, because they're saying the exposure first occurred during useful safe life, but then apparently useful safe life has expired, and then later they discover that there's a problem. That is one of those open-ended debates lawyers would love to have about when should you have figured that out, and someone will say, well, I shouldn't have figured it out until I was injured after the useful safe life had expired. And someone says, no, you should have studied it, you should have been aware of it, shoulda, coulda, woulda. So I think that one is still problematic.
And finally, Representative Mannix, would you be arguing that the current law is just fine and we don't need to change it?
Madam Chair, no. I actually think that the legislature ought to direct an interim committee to do a careful evaluation of statute of limitations and statute of ultimate repose and look for some simplification. We have a couple of exemptions that we put into the law that probably are no longer necessary because the cases have been dealt with. On the other hand, we have modern science available to us. We ought to be taking a look at the new technologies that have been out there in terms of manufactured products, for example, and what the standards are in regard to useful life. And I have not seen, but I haven't checked everywhere, but from just general reading, I've not seen a legislature say we want to have a careful review of these forces at work. Now, most of the people in the room behind me probably wouldn't, I can't speculate, but let's just say businesses don't get nervous about that because they worry, what does that mean? Well, to me, what it means is if it's done properly, we can come up with a design for a matrix that is updated and that will work better. And technology has changed so much in recent years, and we haven't redesigned our matrix. But this isn't a redesign. This is just firing a few buckshot holes through it.
So you agree it needs to be changed, you just don't think we're ready to do it yet, without more study.
Madam Chair, that's with the amount of information that has not been gathered and discussion which has not occurred in this session. And I do think it's something that takes a careful, about a one-year process. If you really want to have all the input, and the legislature certainly could call upon such a review. And I think Oregon could be in the forefront of the states that are saying, hey, look at the electronics technology out there today, and what are we doing about that? And I'll use one simple example and wrap up. The arguments about the impacts of certain electronics on our bodies. Well, maybe we should be looking at that.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And next I will call, looks like Jim Gardner. And why don't we call a couple more people up, too? We have quite a few people signed up to testify, Howard Worth and David Marks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm here today for Pharma, and I had the dubious honor, I guess, of kind of serving as the lead witness for the business community in the House Judiciary Committee, and I want to begin in opposition to House Bill 2909 as introduced, and I want to begin by reflecting on a comment that Representative Hunt made just a moment ago, which is that this bill was sent to you by the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee is the committee that is given jurisdiction to consider issues like statutes of limitation, statute of repose, product liability, and you might want to ask yourself, what's this bill doing here? And I can provide an answer to that question. The reason this bill is here is because there were not sufficient votes to send any version of that bill, and numerous versions were considered right on up to A9 in the Judiciary Committee. And that itself should be an occasion for reflection. In particular, the version that has been presented to you today, the A12, absent the halide carve-out, which I'll get to in just a moment, that particular version was considered and rejected by the House Judiciary Committee. And I'll go into a little bit of the reasons I think that occurred. I can't read their minds, but at least some of the considerations that were provided to them. I have given you two documents. One is a statement of opposition to 2909 as it emerged, as it was sent to you by the Judiciary Committee, and the other is a letter that urging you to reject this bill, which is essentially signed by most of the business interests that are represented in the Capitol, as well as the Oregon Medical Association, from whom you will be hearing testimony a little bit later. Oregon already has serious problems with its tort business climate. The 2006 State Liability Systems Ranking Study, published by the U.S. Chamber, ranks Oregon 30th of 50 states in terms of the fairness and reasonableness of its liability system. And you might ask, well, how can that be true if it looks like we're in the favorable column when it comes to statutes of repose? And the answer is, as Mr. Mannix indicated, that the tort climate is a composite of various factors, not merely the statute of limitations length, the statute of repose length, but such elements as the proclivity of this state to award punitive damages. And I can assure you that Oregon is one of the most aggressive states in the country in terms of punitive damage awards, has been repeatedly reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court for that. So that is a factor that goes into that composite, and the composite puts Oregon right now at, in the lower half of the class, and we would decrease our rank if this were if this bill were to pass as indicated by the Dash 12s. Now, Representative Rosenbaum asked a question: do you think that the statute of repose limitation is just fine the way it is? And I would respond to that by saying that the business community in the Judiciary Committee, and as embodied in the Dash 2s and Dash 10 amendments, was fully prepared to agree to an increase of the ultimate limits on the statute of repose by 4 years. And that would have put us in the mainstream of those states which have product liability statute of reposes. That would have been a very substantial increase, essentially a 50% increase to the 8 years. But we were unable to get agreement to that compromise. Another step that we took was to agree to a carve-out for the so-called COX-2 inhibitors. That bill is already passed the House floor, I believe. And to recognize that as a legitimate exception. Likewise, we were willing to agree to a carve out for the defective metal halide lights, the same carve out that you see in the Dash 12. So we think we came a very, very long way in terms of meeting the legitimate concerns that were expressed. Now, the basic problem with the Dash 12 amendments, the same problem as the Dash 5 amendments, and these are the concerns that the House Judiciary Committee heard and ultimately refused to endorse those and report them out to the floor. They do not achieve the certainty that a true statute of ultimate repose is intended to provide. In particular, the language on beginning on page 1, line 20, effectively abrogates the protections that are intended to be afforded by a true statute of repose. Now, while Washington's product liability repose statute, upon which the Dash 12s are modeled, takes a similarly soft approach by basing the repose period on the useful safe life of a product, the risk to manufacturers of stale lawsuits in Washington is dramatically offset by the fact that Washington does not allow punitive damages. And that makes a world of difference in terms of what it costs, what factors you have to put into the pricing of a product, a world of difference. In addition to the problem of uncertainty resulting from this soft approach to repose periods, it is unclear how the useful life of a product, like, for instance, a prescription drug, would be determined. What is the date on which a purchased prescription drug will not reasonably be expected to perform in a safe manner or could not reasonably be stored in a safe manner? Would it be the expiration date written on the medication container? If so, the useful life of a statute of repose could be as short as 1 year, less than the statute of limitations. And it is my client, but I can tell you, I think that's unfair. That's not a reasonable, clear line period. We were trying to come up with something that would liberalize the statute of repose in a reasonable manner, adding 50% to it, but that was not met with favor in the Judiciary Committee. I want to just conclude by giving you a little bit of history, a trip down memory lane about where the current law came from. And I was, along with Mr. Lane, was closely involved in the process that brought you the current law. It was two sessions ago, and the Oregon Supreme Court, in an uncharacteristically pro-business decision, the Gladhart decision, had just come down with a case which essentially created a 2-year statute of repose. It said that what is known as the discovery rule, which is that you had 2 years after you discovered or should have reasonably discovered a claim, was not explicit in the statute and therefore did not exist. And on behalf of the business community, we recognized that that was a harsh rule. It was overly harsh. And we, along with the trial lawyer community, came forward with a reform proposal, House Bill 2080, which is what you see codified today in the law. And I just want to read just a couple of things from the minutes of the House Judiciary and Senate Judiciary Committee that will reflect the level of consensus that then existed with regard to this. This is,
if you could, I don't know how long that
very is. Short.
We have quite a few witnesses.
Yes, I think this is very important, Madam Chair, and it's very short. This is Rich Lane, Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. States this is almost a consensus bill as far as correcting the two mistakes caused by Gladhart and Canberry cases. Testifies in support of House Bill 2080 with amendments. And then on the Senate side, again, Rich, for the trial lawyers, testifies in support of House Bill 2080, explains the purposes of this legislation, and gives examples of when it would be needed. That's the record. We were all with hands joined in support of it then. I'd like to repeat that that example once more and give a reasonable extension to the statute of repose for 4 years.
Okay. I think we'll hear from all of you before we take questions. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Howard Worth. I'm a Senior Vice President of Gunderson. We're a Portland-located company. We manufacture rail cars. We employ over 1,100 people. Gunderson is part of the Greenbrier Companies. Greenbrier manufactures rail cars not only in Oregon, but in Mexico. Also have an operation in Canada and also in Europe. We also provide aftermarket services in terms of maintenance of rail cars. Gunderson and its Portland operations designs and manufactures not only rail cars, but marine products. Gunderson is an integral part of Oregon's manufacturing trader sector economy. We also depend on locally produced steel and other products manufactured in the area to manufacture our products for export out of the state of Oregon. Further, we rely on a strong manufacturing sector. We are opposed to any change in Oregon's statute of repose. We are opposed to House Bill 2909. We acknowledge that there needs to be accountability for pork products and the injuries that may result, but this is not the right bill. This bill casts a wide and careless net over business that will drive up insurance costs, increase needless litigation, and provide no protection for consumers. From a public policy perspective, this bill will have a widely different impact on Oregon's economy, particularly that sector that manufactures and provides manufacturing jobs. This bill is a direct attack on an economic strategy provide strong workforce and retain family-raised jobs in the state. Oregon is a strong supporter of programs to do that with the governor's office and other individuals and other parties, and this bill can also threaten those programs. According to a recent report by the Manufacturing Institute, manufacturing comprises 25% of Oregon's gross state product for a total of $31 billion. Oregon is second after Indiana in manufacturing's contribution to its economy. Further, the Manufacturing Institute report found that increasing legal claims and expenses has resulted in a loss of more than 60,000 manufacturing jobs in the United States. The question is do we want to enact a law that impacts Oregon's manufacturing sector? Do we want to risk those family wage jobs that are essential to Oregon's economic prosperity? Gunderson's products are manufactured in Mexico, Canada, and elsewhere in the United States. We operate in a very competitive environment where dollars can make the difference between being awarded an order or losing an order. House Bill 2909 will impact our competitiveness by increasing our insurance costs. I recently had a conversation with our insurance advisors and underwriters, and they indicated that we should expect to see increases in our insurance costs if House Bill 2909 was to pass. Using Washington State's useful lives criteria is not an acceptable alternative. Washington limits its punitive damages one can receive. Oregon punitive damages statutes are not as limiting. By going to a useful life criteria, the bill increases the exposure for products that are long-lived in nature. Our products, if properly maintained, can be used for up to 50 years. This bill increases the risk of our products when we have no control or responsibility or however they're maintained. Asking a manufacturer to be accountable for acts of others that we have no control over is poor public policy. This bill would result in us being forced into needless litigation to prove that we were not responsible for a defect or injury or death that may have occurred from the use of our product after it was outside of our control. Finally, the bill, as drafted, is retrospective in nature. It opens up manufacturers to potential lawsuits, regardless of their merits, for products that are already outside the statute of repose. Concluding, House Bill 2909 is a threat to Oregon's manufacturing sector. It communicates that Oregon is not business friendly. It threatens our ability to compete in the global economy, and it threatens Oregon's manufacturing jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Your testimony, please go ahead.
Good morning. My name is David Marks. I own Marks Metal Technology, a typical small family business that looks to the manufacturers in Oregon for their revenue base. We, along with the many, many other small family business, enjoy the efforts that the large manufacturers bring into our community, that our economy as small business flourishes off of. So this bill adds a level of uncertainty, lack of predictability, that in a way jeopardizes my ongoing revenue stream for my small family business. 1,100 employees, 50, 60 employees, it's still providing family jobs for our economy. The last is the image of manufacturing. We have lost many manufacturers in Oregon. This is just one more hurdle that manufacturers have to live with, the uncertainty, the lack of predictability. So as you've heard from the professionals, you've heard from the attorneys, I'm just a layman encouraging you not to support this bill and move it out of the committee.
Questions for these witnesses? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. And again, I appreciate your patience in trying to get through all the information here. Your products sell, correct me if I'm wrong, in California, in Delaware, in Idaho, in Maryland. And you seem to be able to sell those products without major hurdles, yet if we had similar laws to California, Delaware, Idaho, somehow that would hurt Oregon manufacturing. I'm not quite getting the concept.
Again, I am not an attorney, so but I can put it to you in this perspective. Our product is used in interstate commerce. It's used throughout the United States, Canada, and Mexico. There are various jurisdictions that, as you just mentioned, that may or may not have statutes of repose. However, this opens and increases the risk, and I can give you an example. I'm becoming intimately familiar with the statute of repose because we're involved in some litigation surrounding this exact issue in Texas. And it's costing us a significant amount of money and resources to sort out the facts of the case, sort out what the issue is, who's responsible, who's accountable for it. Having some form of protection is better than no protection at all. Again, a lot of times where the action will occur depends on where the injury or derailment in this particular circumstance may occur. In this case, it happened in Texas. So it can vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But again, I'm probably, you know, getting way out on a limb in terms of my lack of legal knowledge here.
Look, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buckley, let me take a crack at that. You will have plaintiffs who will forum shop, who will look for essentially a favorable venue. But if the venue of the headquarters of the company is favorable in terms of no limitations on statute of repose, or very lax limitations on a statute of repose, that will become a very favorable venue in which to bring a lawsuit because the defendant's right there. And so that tends to be a factor that discourages someone from citing a headquarters or a major facility there because they've automatically created nexus when they've made the facility there or located the headquarters there. Doesn't mean they can't be sued elsewhere,
right.
But it's just it's a very convenient place to sue a defendant if they happen to have both a lax statute of repose, statute of limitations, and headquarters and or major plant there.
Thank you for the answer. I just know that Texas does have a 15-year statute of repose, and again, most states do not have one. So again, I'm trying to get my mind around how this disadvantages our state. So thank you for it. Please.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, in recent weeks, you, as responsible for the operation of Oregon, the state of Oregon, were concerned about the uncertainty of the economy, and you work towards providing a rainy day fund.
Okay.
That's directing towards the uncertainty of the economy. What this bill is doing is placing more uncertainty onto the manufacturers when that door is always open. So just like in your case, you didn't want the uncertainty of what could happen in the economy. Manufacturers don't want to have added uncertainty placed upon them.
And, I mean, I'm certainly sympathetic that we don't want to do anything in this bill that is going to really damage Oregon businesses, because we really value a strong economy and the jobs that you provide. But, I mean, I'm looking at two lists, one of which shows where the states are at on this law, and it looks to me, by my count, like at least 32 states do not have a statute of ultimate repose at all. And one of them is Delaware, which on your list, Mr. Gardner, is the number one state in the Chamber of Commerce ranking for the friendliest to business in terms of lawsuits. So I don't quite see how changing our law would really tip the scales in some irrevocable way.
Madam Chair, let me try to respond to that by saying the chamber list is a composite of a number of factors, and certainly you don't reverse 180 degrees a ranking by changing one factor among many, but you marginally move the needle in terms of a factor that is frankly somewhat advantageous to Oregon in terms of its business climate, as opposed to, say, its proclivity for awarding very large punitive damage awards.
Okay, any other questions for this panel? Representative Hunt.
Yeah, I actually recommend to my colleagues, if you haven't been to the launch of one of Gunderson's barges. Actually, the last one I saw was heading on its way for Coos Bay, but it was launched up in Portland. They manufacture an amazingly large set of products. But help me understand, Jim, and I'd be interested in the response to the other two. You gave us something, and it's not really labeled as who...
It's mine.
Okay, you'll claim it. I'm hearing from, I think, from at least one of you or two of you, don't extend the statute of ultimate repose at all. I'm hearing from you, extend it, just limit the extension. Maybe talk about the rationale of 14 years from your perspective, and I'm interested in the other two to respond to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, yes, I would on this group, I guess I would qualify as the liberal extender here. So yeah,
that's a rare panel.
It is indeed. I'm reverting, I guess, but the 14 year period, and let me explain how that period works, because the 8-year period is the period of repose, but there is another 2 years tacked onto that if you discover the injury on the last day of the 8th year. So it's in effect a 10-year period under that scenario. It's last year of 8 year plus 2 years of discovery. That is in line with right now what our major competitor countries, European Union, Japan, South Korea, Australia, all have as a repose period. Those are the people that Gunderson has to compete with. 14 years tends to be in the middle of those states that have repose periods for product liability actions. And so that's my rationale for that.
I guess I'd be interested in from the other two of you what your reaction is to that, because I thought I heard you say don't extend it at all.
At our point right now, that is our position. That doesn't mean that it can't be reviewed again, but given the products we produce, given the type of market that we deal in right now, we feel firmly in leaving the way the law is right now.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, one of my passions is growing and stabilizing and securing manufacturing in Oregon. and that's an image. And the image of manufacturing presently is hurting us on the workforce side. Well, we're dealing with an image here, too. How does Oregon support manufacturers? And in the laws and in the regulations is one way that you support or not support. So the movement, the increase, the adding the complexity, it's not a move of supporting manufacturer. It's just one more hurdle. It is just one more area of uncertainty. And that's why status quo is better than moving forward.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Sure, follow up.
Thank you. Is your perspective that having the current standard of a year limit, whether that was 10 or 14 or 18, I mean, having that standard of a year limit is something that gives you a greater level of certainty than the useful life standard? Pretty much, would you say, regardless of what the length of the years is?
Let me respond to that quickly, Madam Chair, Representative Hunt. Absolutely, that's the essence of the approach that Oregon has taken, and has taken, you know, for many years, interrupted only by the Gladhart decision two sessions ago, but. We think that's that gives the level of certainty that that you need in terms of cost calculations and maintaining a competitive manufacturing environment.
Madam Chair and Representative Hunt, I'd like to respond to that as well, and that having that certainty, particularly in a product like rail cars or marine products, which have, if, as I said it earlier, properly maintained, can last up to 50 years. If not properly maintained by third parties, because it's no longer under our control, things as like wheels, couplers, other wear parts have to be replaced in normal maintenance cycles. If the owner of the car at that point is not doing that properly, and there results in an accident or an injury of some sort, and then we get drug into that, that could happen in year 15, 16, 17. That's when the cars are starting to show their use and so forth beyond that initial 8-year period.
And a final question for Mr. Gardner. I wanted to ask you again about your listing from the National Chamber of Commerce and about Delaware, because someone just passed me a note that said that Delaware has no caps on punitive or non-economic damages and no overall caps on damages, and together with having no statute of ultimate repose, it's still the number one overall state in their ranking of state liability systems as being friendliest to business. So.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think there are about 15 factors that go into the chamber's ranking formula, so they may score well on two of those, but there are a number of other factors. I'd have to analyze, you know, all of the factors as applied to Delaware to really respond adequately to your question. I'd be delighted to do that, but I don't have the information in front of me right now.
That would be great to see what factors and how they came up with this.
I'd be delighted to do that.
Okay, I think we have no more questions. Thank you for your testimony. We have two more witnesses on this bill, and I'll call them together, Genoa Ingram and Jim Denham. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Genoa Ingram with the Oregon State Chamber of Commerce, representing approximately 70 chambers of commerce across this great state of Oregon. We are joining chambers across the nation in opposing any further expansion to the statute of repose statutes. Had a little bit of time, as it happened last night, my car blew up in the driveway of my office building, and I had a good deal of time to research this bill. And in doing so, I did get a chance to go back and listen to the Judiciary Committee hearing, and I have to tell you, I had a great deal of sympathy for that committee. I was appalled by what I heard at the end. And it went something like this. Well, we have to do something. Well, there's too many amendments. There's 10 sets of amendments. We haven't had a chance to review them all. Well, if we don't do something, the bill is going to die. Well, let's go with these amendments. And this gets voted down. And so let's go with these amendments. And those get voted down. And there were no less than 4 or 5 votes. And it was just so chaotic. And I felt so bad listening to that committee trying to grapple with this issue. I would just assert to you that there has just not been given enough time and study and consideration to what you have before you today. Very quickly, most of what I wanted to say has been addressed, but I want to address the matrix. I don't profess to be an expert. I'm not an attorney, but I will tell you something I do know about is ethics. And if I were to do a matrix of the ethics laws, and say Oregon had a law that said you could not buy more than $5 worth of food and beverage for a legislator, and you were to look at that.
In this chamber.
Yes. For example, if you were to say, you know, $5, you were to look at all the other states, you'd say, wow, Oregon is the most ethical state there is. But if we had a statute, and again, I'm just dreaming here, and I have cars on my mind again because of last night, but if our statute said on a specific date every year, lobbyists could give legislators a new Mercedes, and that didn't show up in the matrix, you know, obviously that's not going to show up. I am happy to talk with Ms. Sinclair and other representatives at our U.S. Chamber of Commerce and look at all of those factors for you and give the committee members a list of factors that go into that ranking. That was something, again, that I looked at last night when I was doing research on the bill. For the business community, I will just say that this particular proposal does add more uncertainty, more liability, and more litigation to what they do in day-to-day life, and it does not make for a happy business environment, and we would prefer that the bill go away altogether. If you have questions, I'd be happy to artfully dodge them or better yet defer to Mr. Gardner.
We'll hold questions until you've both testified. Please go ahead. Thank you,
Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Denham. I'm the general counsel for Wachang, an Allegheny Technologies company located here in Albany. We're a manufacturer of specialty metals such as titanium, zirconium, and niobium used in aerospace, medical, energy, chemical processing, recreational, and other applications. Allegheny Technologies employs nearly 1,500 people in family wage manufacturing jobs in the state of Oregon. I'm also the president of the Oregon Metals Industry Council, which is a coalition of metals manufacturers and fabricators in the state. OMIC has been active on this bill since the beginning, but I wanted to reinforce our position on this bill before this committee. We're opposed to changes in Oregon statute of repose, and we're opposed to House Bill 2909. This would drive up insurance costs, it would increase needless litigation, and it will not provide meaningful protection for consumers. This bill is totally inconsistent with our goal to grow and expand the manufacturing sector of the economy to provide more family wage jobs. It is not business friendly. It threatens the ability of the manufacturing sector to compete in the global economy. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Just one question. Thank you. Ms. Ingram, the Dash 12 amendments have the portion concerning the light bulbs. And do you have any position on that particular issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I have not taken these amendments nor that particular issue to the chambers. It's my understanding, though, that the business community as a whole was willing to let that amendment go through, and we would defer to them. Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, we will not be working this bill today. I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2909A, but we will be taking it up again soon.
There you go.
And I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3321. And Mr. Stembridge, would you like to tell us about this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, on House Bill 3321, the relevant issue, I understand, is the Dash 4 Amendment, which provides for the creation of health benefit plans issued to small employers through association health plans. believe everyone has a copy of the Dash 4 amendments.
And Dash 4 should be in your file.
The Dash 4 replaces the bill.
Okay, I think, well, we have some witnesses signed up to testify. I assume they may be wanting to tell us about this version of the bill. And then Representative David Edwards, if you're listening, we are now on House Bill 3321, so we would love to have you join us in Hearing Room E. I think he wishes to testify as well. So we will call Lisa Tressel and Jessica Adamson, if you'd like to come up here together. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors to testify in support of the Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 3321. This is a bill that is a product of a great deal of work by the association community, the insurance division, and with special thanks to the Speaker's office and Dimitri in his office that have done a great job in helping us bring us all around the table to work out a compromise on this very important issue. To start, that Oregon law currently provides for the ability for trade associations or other employer groups to come together and use pooling to create additional choices for employers to provide health insurance for their employees. This is a great...
Jessica, hold that thought for just a sec. We've been joined by Representative Edwards. And Representative Edwards, we are taking testimony on House Bill 3321. So if you'd like to come forward and join this panel, I'm sure they would love to have you as their centerpiece.
Figuratively speaking.
Eye candy. I think he prefers to be known.
Okay. Would you like Representative Edwards to testify? Or
continue, Jessica.
Go quickly. Thank you. Madam Chair, Oregon law currently allows us to use this practice. Unlike what you may have heard about the federal legislation for good or bad, Oregon associations are required to provide to abide by all patient protection, consumer protection, and any mandates imposed by the legislature. So these are full service plans. They are the kinds of plans that small employers could not get on their own. Small employers are limited to purchasing health insurance through what's called the C-HI market or the small employer health insurance market. The rating structure of that market is regulated through statute and by the insurance division, and generally some of the plan offerings are as well. The association market, known as discretionary trusts, association health plans, and what are called MIWAs. These organizations are treated as large groups, which means that we can go out into the market, negotiate directly with insurers in a nice way, beat them up a little bit, and try and get the best deal that we can for our employers, whether they have 5 employees or 30 employees or 50 employees, it doesn't matter. We're able to put together a plan that particularly for small employers, they would not be able to get on their own. In AGC's particular example, we're able to provide them with several different choices that are bundled together with online claims administration, payment, life insurance policy, wellness benefits that all come together that individually, if those employers were to want to purchase all this, they would have to go out in the market and purchase them individually. That would be very expensive, and in some cases, the employers wouldn't offer insurance at all, certainly not to the extent that they're able to purchase it through an association. We aren't the only ones in that situation. AOI, some of the other folks have been working with us on this issue include the Associated Builders and Contractors, Plumbing, Cooling, and Heating Contractors, the Independent Electrical Contractors, the Restaurant Association, and many others provide these kinds of plans that are a tremendous benefit. Last summer, there was some disagreement between the association community and the insurance division about whether these kinds of plans had a negative impact on the market as a whole. We believe that that was not the case. The insurance division had some concerns about what could happen in theory should the association market start to pull good risk out of the small employer health insurance market and leave the small employer health insurance market with solely bad risk. The reality is our plans have extremely high retention rates. We grow very little, but have very high. In AGC's case, over the last 5 years, we haven't had a retention rate less than 95%. So that, and that's true generally across the association market. What that means is the folks that are leaving our association, they're going out of business, or they're just dropping health insurance altogether. We aren't kicking anybody out. We want them to stay. It's quite frankly, from a business practice as an association, you don't want to kick your members off of a product because they tend to drop their membership, and that isn't useful. So we have very much a vested interest in keeping these folks there, but out of concern for that, what we have done in response to some concerns by the insurance division, come up with a kind of a matrix solution to this issue. What the Dash 4 amendment does is prescribe a series of conditions under which an association can retain the rating flexibility we have today. If we don't meet these, then we are subject to the small employer health insurance market rating for those employers that are under the number of employees as designated by the CHI market. So you have a piece of paper in front of you that outlines what those standards are. I'll let Ms. Trussell walk through them or defer to Representative Edwards to provide his testimony prior to that, whichever works best for the committee.
I think we'll hear from all of you before we take questions. So, Representative.
Go ahead, Ms. Trussell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for taking our testimony today on this important bill. Jessica outlined the background very well. I wanted to point out that AOI Health Choice has been a product that we've developed at the request of our members about 10 years ago, and we've had two dips that probably would have put us below the 95, probably around 88%. And both of those occurred. One was when...
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries.
Great. Thank you. We all know you, but the microphone doesn't.
We had two dips, and one of them was when, and neither of them was because we ousted members or encouraged them to leave us, but it was customer service. We use a third-party administrator to do the invoicing and to transmit eligibility information to the carriers, and we had a TPA that was in Denver, Colorado. They sold our book of business to a small TPA firm in Florida who couldn't get an invoice right. Right, and that tends to upset your members when every month their bill is wrong and the corrections are wrong. So at that time, we had to discontinue that relationship and transfer the business, and we found someone in Oregon, Western Benefits, Inc., which is owned by Ross Dwinell, who used to lobby a lot on workers' comp issues. And the customer service has been great. Our members love him. The agents love him. He knows how to issue an invoice that's the correct amount. But you had, it wasn't the pricing thing or that we were trying to get rid of them. It was customer service. And the other time was when we had to change carriers. And we've had different carriers throughout the life of the program. And we're currently, when we've had to change carriers, you sometimes don't retain the members because they'll stay with the carrier that issued the policy as opposed to necessarily following the association to the new carrier. And the other thing I wanted to comment on is that we use agents in all of our, when they quote AOI Health Choice, we appear on a spreadsheet with the other carriers that they're quoting for their client. On the handout, it, as Jessica had indicated, that the intent of the amendments, which we got late last night, but as, you know, looking through them, they seem what we're trying to accomplish is what's on this piece of paper, and that's that the access standards. We won't use health status to determine if they can get into our plans, and that had been a concern of the insurance division, and we all pretty much agreed, no, Oregon, you don't use health status. And that the subgroups, when they're initially coming into our plans, the first year, will use the 3-to-1 rate band, which I think is similar to what you passed out, to the House passed in House Bill 2002, and that the program's open to all our members. For AOI, our program's open for companies with 2 to 75 employees. Some of the other associations had a different minimum requirement, and those ones, those groups with the different minimum requirements or the different requirements are going to be grandfathered in on size-wise. The retention standards Jessica hit on was 95%. And that would not include the businesses that are either acquired, merged, or go out of business. They're no longer members in our association, so they're not eligible to participate, or they don't meet our participation requirements to get into the health plan. An example of a participation requirement with AOI is that they have to have 90% of their employees in Oregon. So if somebody went to 89%, we wouldn't be able to take them. And then the 95% is a critical issue, and that is that if you fall below that, then you'll have basically a year to correct. And beyond that, you would, for those groups, as Jessica indicated, you'd fall under the CHI rating factors. The insurance division was concerned about out-of-state associations, and I think we all are, so we agreed they ought to play by the same rules we're playing by. Let's see. Oh, and then again, there's going to be reporting because this was based on a perception that maybe associations were cherry picking, which I don't like that term because if I'm cherry picking, I'm not doing a very good, I'm not doing it successfully because we've had rate increases. I should be doing a better job. But so we're going to report data so that the department can see who's leaving our groups and why and that type of information. And the carriers will put that in as part of their reporting requirements that you legislated last session. The claims experience, the enforcement, we've already indicated on that, that would lose the exemption from the CHI rules if we fall below that. And we're going to monitor to see what we're actually doing and the impact we're having on the market. The bill has a 6-year sunset. What AOI plans on doing is we're going to ask our carrier partners if they would self-report or at least track for us what their retention rate in the CHI market is so that we can see are we retaining a lot more than the regular CHI market? Are we losing a lot more than the regular CHI market? But that's just an extra piece of information that will be helpful to compare us to what's happening in the CHI market. And with that, I'll stop talking. I would ask for your support of the bill, please. Dashboard.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, committee members. It's a pleasure to be before you this morning. For the record, my name is David Edwards. I represent House District 30, which encompasses Greater Hillsboro, North Plains, and the communities of Roy and Verbort out in Washington County. I'm here in support of House Bill 3321 as a small business owner. Former legislative analyst and current legislator. Entrepreneurs, innovators, and small businesses are key players in the economy of Oregon. They make up most of the employer firms in the state, and their contribution is indispensable. This bill will help improve the competitiveness of small businesses by allowing them to continue to participate in group health insurance plans that use the advantages of large pools of insured to structure affordable coverage. There are three primary advantages to...
Representative Edwards, could I just clarify? You're speaking to the Dash 4 amendments, is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. There are three primary advantages to this bill. Marketing efficiencies. Basically, associations will allow small companies like mine to allow associations to comparison shop on our behalf and get better deals. Secondly, increase choice for employees by representing hundreds, if not thousands, of member companies. Associations can offer an array of benefit plans that otherwise would not be available to small companies like mine. And finally, reduce administrative costs. By self-funding their benefit programs, an association can gain a number of administrative savings that large employers currently enjoy and small businesses do not. In a small group and individual insurance market, about one-fourth to one-third of every premium dollar is spent on administrative costs, including premium taxes, commissions, and compliance costs. Large self-funded employers are exempt from many of these costs and can reduce them to as little as 10 or even 5%. In my own case, I have had an 18-person company since the year 2000. We have experienced double-digit premium health insurance premium increases every year in a range of 18% to 22% a year. Last year, we encountered our lowest double-digit increase at 11%. But for the additional cost I've been paying in health insurance premiums, I could have hired between two or three high-wage positions. I'm spending, on average, somewhere between 18% and up to 24% of salary on health insurance for my employees. And we provide 50% of medical for our employees and their dependents, as well as 100% of vision and dental. As a small company in a highly competitive field, we think it's important to provide high quality and affordable health insurance, and being part of a larger association, as indicated by House Bill 3321-4, would provide us some competitive advantages that we don't currently enjoy.
Thank you for your testimony. I had just one question I wanted to clarify on the record, and I see that the Department of Consumer and Business Services is in the room, too. There was some federal legislation, I think, within the last couple of years that was also being referred to as Association Health Plans or the NZ Bill. My understanding is this is a very different piece of legislation than that was, and specifically, I just want to get on the record that my understanding is there's nothing in this bill that would take away the coverages that we have in Oregon law, like mammograms or women's health exams or the other mandates that are currently covered in law. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Lisa Tressel, go ahead.
Sorry.
I was going to call you representative.
Thanks for the promotion.
Not sure.
Associations in Oregon are required to provide the patient protection and to comply with all the mandates.
Thank you for that clarification. Questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, we are in a work session. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Berger.
I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3321 be adopted.
Representative Berger moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 3321. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. And Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 3321 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Representative Berger has moved House Bill 3321 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say, you know, beginning of this session and all during the times that I've been a legislator, pooling has always been a good way of helping people afford these different issues, and to have business coming to us and saying, you know, we want to have these association deals to pool again, to give the opportunities we can to our people, I think is just one of the things we need to do, and I'm proud of the things we've done before, and I'll be proud to support this bill.
Yes, Representative Berger.
I have felt, listening to this testimony, that I'm walking into the end of a conversation that's been going on for a long time, and I would like to applaud all those people who have worked to make this be a nice bill that is going to help a lot of folks in Oregon in a complex and complicated arena. So thank you to those who worked so hard to bring it to us.
Yes, I would agree with the members' comments. I think that we've been trying to do something about affordability for health insurance and particularly for the small business market for a long time, and I think that you have come up with a proposal that is a workable experiment. I'm pleased to see that the Department of Consumer and Business Services is going to be actively involved in monitoring the results and making sure they work well and that there's a sunset so we can come back and take a look at it in the future. And so I think it's a great bill, and I'm pleased to have my name on it as the chief sponsor, even though it wasn't the bill I thought I was sponsoring, but I think it's an excellent bill.
Good effort, Madam Chair.
Support it. Further discussion? Seeing none. Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
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 Motion carries. And even though I am the chief sponsor, I believe that Representative David Edwards would like to carry this bill, so we will assign him as the carrier. And I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3321. And I will briefly open a work session on House Bill 3539. Members, this is a bill that we heard the other day. I know that some members have been working on possible amendments, so let's just have a brief discussion about it. We're not going to actually vote on it this morning. Go ahead, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had some amendments prepared, the purpose of which is to strengthen sort of the, in a way, the position of the employers in terms of what their options are with regard to trying to keep the safety issue, make clear that safety issues are addressed properly, and also sort of the cost of business in this when employees are gone for religious purposes. I am not at this point quite comfortable enough with the language of this amendment to introduce it. Would ask your indulgence for to postpone this for a while, a day or another session to kind of work a little bit more on that language.
Okay. Yes, Representative Hunt.
And there's also, Jim is handing out right on cue, dash two amendments, which are largely the same amendment that you saw in the dash ones that really correspond the bill specifically to the federal law. The one addition you'll note here is at the very end on page two of the dash two amendments, lines 6 through 10. The school district specifically raised a concern about another statute that this basically just makes it explicitly clear that that does not limit that other statute. We can debate that other statute another day, but this this bill at least says that it doesn't impact the additional statute related to public schools and religious dress. And I will be happy to work with Representative Berger on the dash three amendments. I never thought I'd see another bill this session that would have the words safety and staffing in it. I would have done with that issue, but it's back.
We're substantially done.
Basically, the dash twos replace the dash ones then?
Correct, yeah. So the dash twos incorporate everything from the dash ones with the addition of that additional exclusion for public schools.
Madam Chair? Yes. Vice Chair Buckley?
Representative Hunt, has discussion come up about police officer uniform? Has that been part of the discussion? I mean, I'm glad to see that the teacher exemption here. In conversations I've had with people about the bill, people have wondered what if a police officer is wearing religious clothing, does that change the nature of the uniform? Does a municipal police force would they have to adjust to this and say, we have a Buddhist temple in Southern Oregon, and would a police officer wearing a Buddhist robe? I guess that's a concern I have.
That concern has not been raised, so thank you for raising that concern. I think we may be able to address this in the safety issue. Obviously, for a police officer, they've got to be wearing a uniform where they have access to their weapon, their handcuffs, whatever else the
clearly identifiable
police officer.
Right.
So, I mean, if it was religious dress that impeded that, that would obviously be problematic. I think the flip side may be that if it is, some of the testimony we had earlier in the week, if it is you know, some headdress that really doesn't impact,
right.
You know, if it's a yarmulke, I'm not sure how that impacts negatively, certainly safety, and I'm not sure it even necessarily, I wouldn't see the impact on that and the ability of the officer to do their job. The core goal here is to make sure that there is accommodation unless it, where is that language? The undue hardship, I guess it's in line 7 on page 1 of the dash 2s, unless it poses an undue hardship on the employer. And obviously anything that impacted their ability to do the core functions of their job would have an undue hardship.
I guess a concern, if I could follow very briefly, a concern I would have is if a police force, if multiple members of a single police force were all of the same religious denomination and were wearing articles associated with that denomination, it's a rather far-fetched possibility, mm-hmm. but it could put a appearance on that police force that it is not a municipal police force, but in some respect a religious police force, and I would have concerns with that.
Okay, and Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I appreciate the addition of the schools, though I don't think it was necessary in my questions that I asked. I felt very comfortable that the issue in schools is a right in our Constitution, and it's clear in the federal Constitution and our Constitution against the prohibition of taking on and making the religion part of the. I'm trying to remember what part of the Constitution is. I remembered it then. But this is pretty clear in law already. Our law would not have changed that. We can't. Establishment clause has been used repeatedly to show that teachers cannot have garb. And that would continue, and when we asked the question about establishment clause, all of the people on this bill said that absolutely true. We can't change the Constitution by having a statute. So I don't think it would have been necessary. I think it clearly states it. That's a good thing for people, so they don't think that there is an issue there, but I think it was already there before. But thank you for doing it.
Representative Esquivel?
Yes, I agree with the Southern delegation here on the clothing part. I think we need to be more specific because it's not and have some specificity, because it may not just be police, it may be fire. You know, there's a number of things that we relate to when we look at a uniform. So I agree with my colleague from Ashland that we need to spell that particular piece out, I think. Did you say that, didn't you?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
And Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah. My specific concern is a little bit different in that it's the undue hardship on businesses. There's an awful lot of businesses that are time specific in terms of when their business needs to be done, when the bulk of their business is done, and when they come to hiring people, they can't say, no, I can't hire you because you can't work on this day, but they need people to work on that day, and it. I don't want to get them caught into some sort of a bind where they can't ask religious questions, they can't borrow religious questions, and yet they have to be able to say, we can't operate our business if we have to double up on this day because you can't be there. I don't want them to get caught in that bind, and I worry a little bit of that, because there are an awful lot of businesses that their main business is on days that might be religious holidays for some folks. And so I want them to not get trapped in does that mean that, you know,
Friday night.
You can't work on the days when I need you, and so I have to hire fill-in help for you, and it's costing my business. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I would think that the hardship language, I mean, we've got somebody from the Bureau of Labor and Industries here in the room, and we do have 5 more minutes. If we want them to come forward, we can do that. Would you like to come forward?
Because the hardship language, it references 659A.121, and I don't have that in front of me, but it says allowing those activities does not impose an undue hardship on the employer, and I would think having half of your workforce gone would be an undue hardship for any employer.
Yeah.
So.
Particularly when you're a two-person workforce.
Right, absolutely. So could you please identify yourself for the record and shed some light on that?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marsha Oley-Miller. I'm the legal policy advisor of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And you're absolutely correct that the reference to the undue hardship statute that is actually part of the disability law spells out what kinds of considerations would be reviewed in terms of what kind of hardship this is on a business or on an employer. And I believe that's why in the proposed amendments, that direct link is made with 659A121 because it's not in the bill, but it does show up in at least two of the amendments.
Thanks, Mercer. So is it your testimony that if an employer was going to have a high proportion of their workforce gone on a particular day because they all wanted to take off a holiday that was not normally a holiday, would that qualify as undue hardship under this language?
Well, without having 121 in front of me, which I apologize for not.
Okay, we've all heard it.
That would be great. It is crafted, and it was Oregon language is taken from the Americans with Disabilities Act to cover all aspects of business considerations. So, it lists the nature and cost of the accommodation needed, the overall financial resources of the facility or facilities, financial resources of the employer, size of the business, number of employees, and it really is crafted and has withstood the test of time to cover all the kinds of things you'd look at for a business in terms of what an accommodation would cost them.
And I was actually looking at the paren 1 there that just says an accommodation imposes an undue hardship on the operation of the business of the employer if the accommodation requires significant difficulty or expense. So that language is very broad, and I clearly, if you've got half of your workforce gone, that would qualify as significant difficulty or expense in my reading of this.
Yes, and it's in direct contrast to what has been the standard for religious accommodation, which is de minimis, which is almost no difficulty. So if it causes significant difficulty or expense, that would go to these kinds of factors here. You're looking at these things that would make a big difference in the working of the business.
Any questions for this witness? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, first of all, the undue hardship standard is largely in statute because that is the test that's used for employers may not discriminate based on disability unless the undue hardship standard is met. Is that correct?
With respect to reasonable accommodation of the disability.
And if I could follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you. So has this been a challenging, problematic interpretation in terms of how you as a department have administered it in terms of litigation around it, or has this been pretty clearly delineated?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, if you're talking about our application of it in the disability context, which is where it's existed previously, there is a growing body of law around the hardship and accommodation, and so that is out there for guidance. And I would say accommodation probably comes up as frequently, if not more frequently, than outright discrimination based on disability. Mm-hmm. So it is probably the most frequently probed question in disability discrimination.
Follow up?
So not so much a question. I think one of the challenges for us, and it is very much true as Oregon adopted statutes prohibiting discrimination based on disability, it does create a challenging situation. I think the opportunity for us is to just say we think that discrimination should not be allowed, that free exercise should be allowed. And that's why I think this is a helpful standard. But I will, Representative Berger and I are going to work together to make sure that we've got it right.
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could just put on the record her comment about the most frequently probed sort of area disturbs me a little bit, because I can see we're opening a pretty big door here to an awful lot of more possibilities around this, particularly with the language significantly difficult. I'd like to have a chance to go back and stand with Representative Hunt and others and see if we can come to terms on this.
Okay. Any other questions for this witness? Okay, Marcia, thank you very much
for
your testimony. And So, Representatives Hunt and Representative Berger, do you think that you could resolve this over the weekend if we carried this over to Monday, or would you like us to just post it again for Wednesday?
Whatever you prefer, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Wednesday would suit me as my grandchildren are coming down this weekend, and I'm trying to get out.
You don't want to spend your weekend
with my grandchildren. All right.
I like them better than that.
I'm for whatever Representative Berger's grandchildren decide on this.
So let's check it up again on Wednesday. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3539. And members with nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned.